Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz has thrown his hat into the ring for Congress, and Iowa's top public health official abruptly resigns. What's the story behind these developments? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A Friday News Buzz edition of our program. We'll check in with Dennis Goldford of Drake University with analysis of those and other political developments. Also, ISU's Dave Swenson gives us analysis on the latest jobs numbers, new rules for teen drivers, an ice fishing forecast, potential problems with ice on the Missouri River, and what's to make of this phenomenal start to the season by the Cyclone men's and women's basketball teams. Both squads undefeated. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of our program, a time when we buzz through a handful of developments here in Iowa. Short conversations about all kinds of things coming up this hour. Ice fishing later in the hour, also in the sport corner, I suppose you'd say. What a phenomenal start to the season by the Cyclone men's and women's basketball teams. We'll talk about that. Dennis Goldford will be along to talk about Secretary of State Matt Schultz running for Congress, also the resignation of Marionette Miller Meeks as director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. So many things to come. Let's start off, though, with Iowa State University economist David Swenson. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
We want to talk about some new jobs numbers that are out this morning. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced there were only 74,000 jobs added to public and private payrolls last month in December, but the unemployment rate fell to a five-year low. We're down to 6.7%. First of all, David, how can we fall in unemployment terms with such a meager number of jobs created?
Right. And this is one of the problems we have with trying to understand the payroll figures, the payroll jobs figures, as well as unemployment rate. First off, there's two surveys that are conducted on a monthly basis. The first survey looks at employers, and it's a larger survey, and it counts the change in the number of jobs. And by way of illustration, many of us have more than one job. I work here at Iowa State University, but I also work part-time at the University of Iowa. So statistically, I count as two jobs. Now, we have a second survey, and that's called the Household Survey. And in that survey, it's a continuous rolling survey of the American population, and in that survey, they're asking people whether they're employed. Now, going back to my example of myself, I'm just one employed person. So we get two different numbers. The unemployment rate comes from the Household Survey, and therefore, that number said there were more people working and in the economy, and unemployment had gone down, and the combination of those two yields us a lower unemployment rate.
Mm. How much of a surprise was this? Less than 100,000 jobs created. We've been much higher than that in previous months.
Right. They're explaining it away. The experts are saying, well, there's some major seasonal things here. They call it a bad weather effect. We have two things going on. Indeed, maybe there is a bad weather effect because there were strong contractions in construction. Other types of seasonally related jobs were negative. But the other part of that is that the previous 2 months' estimates were revised upwards. And so our rate of gain or our numerical change from last month, made it look worse than it really was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know Iowa's latest numbers came out a couple weeks ago, but how do they fit in here?
Well, they fit in indirectly and directly. Of course, we're part of the national numbers. But what matters to Iowa, first of all, we know that Iowa's in better shape than the nation, but we've been recovering at about the same pace over the last two and a half years as the nation. We don't have any magical, special, extra rate of recovery in Iowa. We just didn't sink as low. And now, once we've all been recovering, we're recovering at about the same pace. But Iowa really depends on the rest of the nation. They buy what we make. We can only produce so much for the Iowa economy. The remainder of the wealth that gets generated in Iowa is a function of what we can export to other states and to other countries. So we have a vested interest in the rate of national growth. National growth has been flat but still expanding, and that's what's going to drive gains in the Iowa economy in upcoming years.
So why aren't we bouncing back as we have in other previous recessions, admittedly shorter recessions?
This is really hard for a lot of people to understand. They want this recession to be something like the average of the previous three or four recessions. The recession that we went through was devastating. It was tremendously worse than anything we'd experienced since the Depression. We sunk way lower, and the pace of recovery has been much slower because of how much damage it was done to so many different sectors of the economy. And it's just a really bad economic train wreck that we're still recovering from.
Okay, the outlook for 2014, what can you tell us about that in closing, Dave?
Well, in general, the outlook looks to be steady but slow growth, not the kind of growth that people want to have, but still growth nonetheless. That goes for both Iowa and the nation.
When we have these really cold temperatures, I drive by construction sites. Not a lot of activity there. Does that affect what you look at here in terms of the state and across the Midwest?
Sure, they're gonna always take into account those types of factors. But we also know that these numbers are seasonally adjusted. So what they're measuring is, are there more workers than would have been expected given seasonal variations? Nationally, there are fewer construction workers.
Okay, Dave Swenson, Iowa State University economist. Thanks for spending time with us.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The University of Iowa will be the first state-supported school to pass a significant milestone in student retention. A little more than 51% of University of Iowa students who graduated last year completed their studies in 4 years. Iowa State University will report a 40.7%, just over 40% four-year graduation rate. And the University of Northern Iowa will report just a little over 37% rate, according to the school's registrar offices. These three state schools reporting their student retention and graduation rates to the Board of Regents. Joining us now to talk about this, Andrew Beckett, Assistant Dean of the University College at the University of Iowa. Hi, Andrew Beckett.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on the program. Give us a sense of the significance of this 51% figure.
Well, it's definitely a nice milestone. Just to give you a little perspective, if you go back 25 years ago, our four-year graduation rate was just under 29%. 10 years ago, we exceeded 40%, and we're now above 50%. The national average for four-year public institutions is right around 31%. So all three of the regent institutions are above the national average. And in fact, actually, if you look at six-year graduation rates, the state of Iowa for its three public institutions is ranked second in the nation behind Delaware for the highest graduation rates.
51% in that context, very high. But why do I have a knee-jerk reaction to say that sounds really low? And we call these four-year programs. But actually, if 51% is a high mark for getting people out in 4 years, they're not really four-year programs, or...
Well, I think I agree with you, and I think that's an interesting perspective. I think particularly when you look at how the public views K-12 education versus higher education, we have a tendency to blame the schools when things aren't going well for graduation rates in high school, and we have a tendency to blame students when they're not doing well in colleges. But having said that, I think there's a number of reasons why that statistic sounds low. Mm-hmm. We lose approximately at the University of Iowa 15% of our students after the first year. It tends to be a time where students are making a tremendous amount of changes in their life. There's academic transitional issues. There's social issues. There's personal issues. Students have a lot of autonomy. And so about half of the students that we lose after the first year. And that tends to be similar across the board. And so what we try to do is create programs that will make that transition as smooth as possible, and then try to identify students who are at risk as soon as possible to try to get them connected to our resources.
Mm-hmm. So what have you put in place that makes you one of the most successful schools in this area in the country?
Well, I think any time with an institution as diverse as the University of Iowa, it's not one thing. We've increased our living and learning community programs. So those are designed to help students make connections with other students and faculty with similar interests. We've increased our orientation programs, trying to help students get acclimated before the semester starts. One of the really important things is to do intentional planning with academic advisors so that you're making very wise choices early on to stay on track. And so we have a four-year plan in which our students meet with advisors, almost to the point of intrusively forcing students to meet with an advisor before they register for courses to try to help them make those decisions. One of the newer programs, which I think is interesting, and to my knowledge, we're one of the few institutions that have tried this, is we're actually starting this summer for full-time students. They can attend a summer term if they're in-state free of cost. We provide them a scholarship so that they can take a full up to 12 hours in the summer without having to pay tuition. So that helps students who may have had a rough go at their first year get caught up on time.
Okay, thank you very much. We want to thank you, Andrew Beckett, Assistant Dean of the University College at the University of Iowa. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the political developments in Iowa, but also nationally. It's been a busy end of the week, and joining us to do that, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, joining us by phone. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
Thank you for dancing out of the lines. It's not a Wednesday, and we get your analysis. Let's start with Iowa developments. Iowa's Secretary of State Matt Schultz formally announcing his candidacy for Congress to represent Des Moines, Council Bluffs, the southwest part of the state, Iowa's 3rd District. This is the seat that the Republican U.S. Representative Tom Latham currently holds. He's announced he won't be seeking that another term there. Schultz is a Republican. What are his strengths and weaknesses as a candidate?
Well, one of the strengths has nothing to do directly with him, and that is that midterm elections tend to favor Republicans. Democrats have more marginal voters, and Republicans are much more likely to turn out in a midterm election. We saw that to a huge extent in 2010. So that helps him to begin with. Second, this looks to be a good year for Republicans. Democrats, of course, want to fight that perception. Republicans want to argue that, it will be good for them.
Mm-hmm.
So those don't pertain solely to Matt Schultz. But Matt Schultz is a young guy. He's run a statewide campaign. He's got an organization that already, by definition, has been successful because he won the Secretary of State's position. He's worked in Polk County. He's made appearances all over the state. He's from the Council Bluffs area, and, of course, Pottawatomie County is part of the 3rd District, so that gives him a certain anchor there. So these, I think, generally are the factors that help him. The question is whether there are factors on the other side. And, of course, the Secretary of State's office is supposed to be a nonpartisan office that takes care of the election machinery and gives people like you and me wonderful databases for looking at voter registration and election results and so forth. And Secretary Schultz has continued the work that Secretary Culver did in that position. And, of course, he used that as a launching pad for his own governor's race, Chet Culver. But there have been two questions about Schultz. One is the question of employing people who raise some questions for him, but more generally the question of his focus on voter fraud. Republicans want to argue this is necessary to ensure the integrity of the voting process. Democrats, looking at nationwide Republican efforts in this area, have been arguing that this is an attempt at voter suppression. So Schultz will have to deal with those.
Mm-hmm. And remind us, how much voter fraud did our Secretary of State actually uncover to cost to us of a couple $100,000? Right?
Yeah, very little. Wasn't it something like a half dozen cases?
Yeah, something like that. I'm thinking in the single digits.
Erroneous.
Yeah, right.
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 So, yeah, the Democrats argue that's a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem. Republicans argue that, of course, we've got to ensure that voter integrity or the process's integrity is at the highest level, which really nobody had questioned.
Mm-hmm. So far, the Democrats have former State Senator Stacey Apple, state senator from 2007 to 2011, in the opposing camp to oppose Matt Schultz. What can you say about her?
Well, she lost a tight race to Kent Sorensen, who, of course, ended up with his own difficulties as far as the state Senate was concerned. But Apple was out there planning to run even against Tom Latham, which would have been a big task. So you got to give her a certain respect for political courage in that regard. She's been making calls to various people, meeting various people. The question, of course, for her is whether another Democrat might decide to come in since it's an open seat.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Matt McCoy, State Senator McCoy's name mentioned in the paper, but we don't really know if that's going to occur yet.
Mm-hmm. Anybody likely to also challenge Matt Schultz for the GOP nomination?
Well, we know we have a whole host of people. We had David Young, who has shifted to from the Senate race to that third district race. He's the legislative aide to Senator Grassley. We've seen mention of David Oman, longtime Republican activist from the more traditional business or establishment wing of the party, and Brad Zaughan, who ran unsuccessfully against Leonard Boswell. There's been some question about whether he would run. He supposedly, at least last week, promised some sort of announcement, but we haven't heard anything yet in particular. And there may be one or two others.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this favors Republicans because it's an off-year election if we look at past elections. But based on voter registration, what can you say about the 3rd District, about who might have the edge there? We have Dallas and Polk counties and also the Council Bluffs area.
Right. I mean, the big population centers of the district, of course, are Polk County, to some extent Dallas County as well, but Polk County and Pottawatomie. They are the major population centers there. In terms of most recent voter registration statistics, there are, in the 3rd District, at 16 counties, there are just under 514,000 voters registered. There is, at the moment, a slight Republican plurality in that district, but as is with the case with the state overall, generally speaking, you can't win a race either district-wide, with the possible exception of the 4th district, but even there, that's not totally the case. But you can't win a race with only members of your own party. You've got to have substantial inroads among the so-called no party or independent registrants.
Let's move on to another late-breaking political story here in Iowa. Iowa's top public health official has resigned after being criticized this week for making unsubstantiated comments about food stamps. Dr. Marionette Miller-Meeks said her decision to resign as director of the Iowa Department of Public Health was unrelated to this dust-up over comments. Instead, she said she was leaving her job so she could concentrate on other options, including a possible third run for Congress. She's run the health department since Governor Branstad took office in 2011. I've listened to the audio. I don't know if you have, Dennis, but she says quite clearly that this is food stamps or the SNAP program, the number one product in Iowa, is Mountain Dew, which turns out not to be true. How could she come to make such an error?
Well, you know, she supposedly was not speaking to a partisan audience, but, you know, that kind of statement, you know, it's not sort of Michelle Bachmann territory, but, you know, Michelle Bachmann got into big trouble talking about vaccinations, I think it was, or something like that because of something she had heard. You know, we all hear things. We've got to be very careful about what we say, particularly if we're a public official or even in Iowa Public Radio or Drake University. We've got to be very careful. But that particular view, whether she meant it this way or not, and the context suggests she didn't really mean it this way, but still, that particular review reflects a standard Republican/conservative view of the social safety net. That is, it's used by people who aren't deserving for purposes for which it wasn't designed.
Mm-hmm.
So it reflects a certain kind of boilerplate attitude toward the social safety net on the part of Republicans and conservatives. This is, of course, why Democrats immediately leapt in to criticize that.
Mm-hmm. Any idea? This was one mistake. Is there more behind this resignation than this one mistake?
Well, I myself don't know yet at this point. She, of course, said they're not related. That may well be the case, but in that sort of circumstance, you don't want to say it's related to that anyway, even if it were, because that suggests that you're acknowledging that you really have committed some substantial error or blunder that's for which you have to be apologetic.
She mentioned a possible run at Congress again. What if she were to run against, say, Dave Loebsack again?
Well, you know that opposition research or YouTube or something on the part of the Democrats will appear in a campaign like that, but that works like that for all campaigns between both parties.
Mm-hmm. We have to turn to the National Front before we say goodbye to you, Dennis Goldfert. By firing one of his top aides and apologizing to the residents of Fort Lee and answering reporters' questions for nearly 2 hours yesterday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie lived to survive another day. How serious is what is being called Bridgegate for him?
Well, you know, his image has been sort of a tough, regular guy. But as much as Republicans talk about the Chicago machine politics of the president, although Barack Obama had no real connection to the traditional daily machine in Chicago, this sort of thing on the part of whoever was responsible in New Jersey really is reminiscent of things I used to see when I lived in Chicago under the old daily machine. This is sort of there's a price for disloyalty in those big city machines, and at least some of Christie's aides made some people pay that price. But I think it offers him an opportunity, on the one hand, to show leadership in the saying, in the situation of saying, look, you know, you got to look out for your enemies, but if anybody can hurt you, it's your friends acting on supposedly your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And here are people who fouled up and heads are going to roll. That can give him a chance to show some leadership in that regard if he's not been involved otherwise.
Right. If we have a smoking gun to write to the governor, then all bets are off for him, right?
Say that again, Ben. Sorry.
If we have a smoking gun tying Governor Christie to this bridge fiasco, then it's a different story.
Oh, that's true. Smoking guns always hurt you. But at the same time, here in Iowa, for example, he's got bigger problems than that sort of issue because, of course, of the now three wings of the Republican Party, the sort of conventional business establishment wing, which tends to be more open to Christie, but the Tea Party and social and religious conservative wings, they're mistrustful of him anyway. This gives them more ammunition or more reason to distrust him.
So Paul Ryan, Rand Paul, rubbing their hands in glee, perhaps.
Oh, they've got to be happy.
Okay. Very quickly, 50th anniversary this week of the LBJ's famous War on Poverty speech. I'm wondering your thoughts. How do we view how that war has gone five decades later?
You know, that's a complex question. I mean, it didn't take long after that till really by the time of Ronald Reagan, people were saying on the Republican side, in the war on poverty, poverty won. The poverty rates haven't really changed significantly since from what they were back then. Again, it's hard for people to take or find a nonpartisan judgment on that.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats want to say there's just a lot more work to do. It's kept things from being worse. Republicans want to say, no, it's worsened things. It's kept people in poverty.
Mm-hmm. The LBJ connection that is often brought up recently is that many Democrats may wish that Barack Obama had the ability to work with Congress. Some might say strong-arm Congress the way LBJ did.
Well, at least 2012, 2011, I heard a lot of Democrats saying, where's LBJ when you need him?
Okay. Dennis Goldfert, thank you so much for joining us on this Friday News Buzz. Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Dennis, always a pleasure.
Yes, it is. Take care.
Take care. And when we come back, new rules for teen drivers. If you've got one of those teens at home who gets behind the wheel, you might want to pay special attention. Also, an ice fishing forecast, potential problems with ice on the Missouri River. We'll talk about that. And this phenomenal start to the season by Cyclone men's and women's basketball. Both squads undefeated. We'll find out what's behind that when we come back. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a News Buzz edition. And as we start the new year, Iowa has new rules for teenage drivers. Now, teens are only allowed one unrelated underage person in the vehicle in the first 6 months they have their intermediate license. And those with an intermediate license will need to have that license longer before getting a full license. Iowa was one of the first states to require a graduated license program. The program started about 10 years ago, and during that time, there have been fewer teen drivers killed in car crashes. Joining us now to talk through these changes, why they are, and what they mean for us in 2014, Mick Mulhern. He's the youth coordinator at the Iowa Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau. Hi, Mick.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us, what are the biggest rule changes here? Tell us what they mean for us right now, especially parents of teen drivers.
The two key points here. The first of all is the instruction permit, where the beginning driver has got to have the instruction permit for 12 months. Previously, it was only 6 months before they could, when they reached the age of 16 to get a license, they could move on and get an intermediate. One of the big reasons for that, Ben, is over the years, although, as you mentioned in your opening, that Iowa has, we've been kind of the leader with the GDL program and kind of set standards, over the years we have lagged somewhat because we haven't evolved. The young drivers with the 6 months were not getting the opportunity to do the full seasonal driving. Like in the state of Iowa, the kids would not get winter driving, ice driving, while on an instruction permit. Where with the 12 months, that will afford them that opportunity. The second area is, in fact, the passenger change. Again, Iowa had a policy where you could have as many passengers in that vehicle as you had seat belts. And one of the statistics that sticks out at us in the Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau is the more teen passengers you get in a car driven by a teen, the risk of a crash goes up significantly. And when you throw in the fact that a lot of backseat passengers are not buckled, it becomes a catastrophe waiting to happen. So a little longer with the instruction permit and the intermediate license holder, that person that turns 16, they can only have one other passenger for the first 6 months during the period that they have their new license.
And of course, Mick, these days a teen is not a teen without some sort of mobile communication device to text or to talk on. Are there rules and any changes to to help lessen the fact that, or lessen the danger of texting while driving and talking on a cell phone while driving for teens?
There is no significant change. We have continued through our office and through other agencies to use the education piece out there to talk to kids, talk to parents. There's already a primary law for under 18 to not use cell phones or any electronic devices while they're driving. Does that stop them? Not necessarily. So we're trying the education piece to show them the dangers, instruct them on different methods and different things that they can do to avoid those crashes that they're inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And remind us, how much more likely are you to have an accident, a crash, if you're texting, for instance?
That's a good point, Ben. If while you're driving, you're 23 times more likely to crash if you're texting, 23 times more likely. And if you're talking on a cell phone, you're 4 times more likely to crash than if you weren't distracted otherwise. Mm-hmm. Very significant numbers.
Have there been any citations issued for teens who are texting and driving in the state?
You know, we have tried to. There have been some, not a tremendous amount. With it being law enforcement has concerns and trying to determine age and so on and so forth of drivers. We do track some. There have been a few over the course of the past year. I don't have that exact number. It's hard to track. And that's why we're going through and trying to hit the education piece as heavy as we can.
What is a driver's education class like these days? It's been several decades since I had mine back at Cedar Falls High. Mm-hmm. Have they changed much?
Over the past 30 years or so, they've changed significantly. I can tell you that as a youth coordinator, I get out to the driver reds at the high schools. I take a driving simulator out. and allow the kids to drive and text on my simulator, use spatial vision goggles. The Driver Ed program is at a point where they're still doing a mandatory classroom, you know, out of the book, out of the study guides, videos, and then they have the behind-the-wheel time, which, again, and this goes back to that learner's permit, where we're hoping to lengthen the learning period so that these young learners have an opportunity to drive in all types of weather, different roadways, and different conditions. But the driver's ed it's stayed the same, with the exception of course, the technology has come forward. So classroom, book time, and behind the wheel.
All right, Mick Mulhern, the youth coordinator at the Iowa Governor's Traffic Safety Bureau. We want to thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me, Ben. I certainly appreciate it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition on this Friday, still to come in a few minutes. Ice fishing conditions and also the Cyclone basketball, men's and women's basketball, having a great start to the season. But first of all, Iowa and Nebraska officials have been keeping watch on an ice-covered portion of the Missouri River for any flood threat it could pose. Joining us to talk about the Missouri at this time of year, Jody Farhat, Chief of Missouri River Water Management Division. And Jody Farhat, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What specifically are you watching for? What's the biggest threat you see?
Well, this time of year, we monitor the ice conditions on the Missouri River very carefully. And we're looking at the area all the way from Montana to Missouri. But in the last couple of weeks, the focus has really been in this area downstream of Gavin's Point Dam, between there and the Sioux City area, where we've had some ice formation.
Mm-hmm. So describe exactly the threat posed by ice. Let me picture it.
Okay. When the river freezes, we start out with just frazzle ice forming, and it forms into ice pads. And those ice pads grow as the temperatures are cold, and eventually they can get hung up on sandbars and bends in the river, bridges, and jam up together and form an ice dam or an ice jam. And, you know, the concern there is that upstream of where the ice gets lodged, the river stages can rise pretty dramatically over a short period of time. Mm-hmm. And then our big concern is downstream of that, the river stages can drop, which could affect the water intakes along the river.
Can you have things like I'm trying to picture this, you can have blockages of ice, and can they give way all at once and then a surge of water come down?
They can. You know, they work as essentially a small dam. There's currently, you know, water moving under that. But when that lets loose, generally in the spring, but it could even with the warmer temperatures we're getting in the next week or so, that water will be released. Because our releases are low during the wintertime, we don't anticipate that that would cause a flooding. But if it occurs in the spring along with rain or runoff from snowmelt, that could cause a flooding risk.
What actually can you do about these large chunks of ice that may act as partial dams?
Our operation is primarily focused on trying to make sure that the water intakes stay online. So in this area where the ice has been forming this winter, we don't have a big flood risk. Our releases are low. The channel is incised. But when it does form, we get this dip moving down the river, which could knock some of the power plants or municipal water intakes offline. So our operations to account for that would be to increase the releases out of the reservoir prior to the ice formation so that that water is moving through there and it protects the intakes.
Still a long way off, though. We're dreaming of spring, but when we think of spring, we have to think of melting ice and snow and its effects on our major waterways. The Missouri River, of course, having flood problems not too long ago. Can you give us any sort of outlook on the melting ice and snow in the spring? What is upstream that, how much is upstream that could go into the Big Muddy?
Okay, the current conditions in the basin, the reservoirs themselves, we are still recovering from the effects of the 2012 drought. So the upper three reservoirs where most of the storages are drawn down 5 to 11 feet right now and below where they should be this time of year. So that provides a great deal of additional flood control storage for us in this coming year. The basin itself, we had a very wet fall in Montana and the Dakotas, so the soil moistures are very wet in that area. And we do have some plain snowpack that is up there now, and the mountain snowpack is a little above normal. So we would think even if we get normal precip for the rest of the year, because the soil is so wet going into fall, that we'll get extra runoff next year. But because we have these reservoirs and they are drawn down, we don't anticipate that that snowmelt will cause a flooding issue like mm-hmm. we saw a couple years ago.
Of course, we still have the potential for plenty more snow and ice to add to that snowpack, don't we?
Right. It's still very early to be looking at it. Typically, in the mountains, at this time of the year, we have about 45% of the peak accumulation. So we still got 3 months to go, 3.5 months to go. So a lot could change in that time.
Chief of Missouri River Water Management Division, Jody Farhat, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and let's keep with the theme of ice, but in a more pleasant way. We all like to complain about the cold weather, except for those who like ice fishing, I guess. We're seeing those curious huts pop up on lakes across the state. Joining us to talk about ice fishing conditions, Mick Klemsrud. He's information specialist for the Department of Natural Resources here in Iowa. Hi, Mick.
Hi, Ben.
Give us an overview on the conditions across the state for ice fishers.
In general, we've got really good quality ice right now. We've been blessed with some cold air since early December. And, the last week or so, we've increased the ice thickness across most of the lakes in the state. We don't have a lot of snow on the ice, which means there's no insulating effect, so the ice can grow as long as the temperatures are down. And we've been blessed and lucky to have some below zero temperatures out there. And
so what are the thicknesses we're seeing? What's the range? Do you know?
Oh, in southern Iowa, you're seeing anywhere from, 9 to 15 inches of ice, depending on the size and the depth of the water body. And across northern Iowa, we're seeing, 19 to 20 inches of ice up there.
Mm-hmm. Is that about as thick as we get in a typical winter?
Well, I don't know what typical is anymore, but I remember cutting through about 30
comment.
Inches
yeah.
of ice.
You remember 30 inches of ice?
Yeah, we've cut through where you had to have an extension on your auger to get through. And that wasn't that long ago. That was back in about 2000, we had a good winter.
Yeah, we did. And that wasn't that a danger for some of the fish because some of the more shallow bodies of water were almost frozen solid?
Yeah, we did have some ponds. And in fact, it happens every year we go into the winter that we have, low water levels, especially in some of those little shallow ones in northern Iowa in the prairie pothole area. If we go in a drought year, and we have a hard winter, they will freeze out. And that's not, you don't want to lose your fishing hole, but that's Mother Nature doing her thing. And that can actually be healthy for a system because rarely do you kill every fish in the system. There will be some left, and then they'll repopulate in that. Or we'll go in the spring and survey and with our equipment and step in where Mother Nature created a void.
With the ice this thick, Mick, certainly probably a lower number of safety concerns, but nevertheless, there are safety concerns, aren't there?
There's always. When we talk to people about ice fishing, we say there's never such thing as safe ice. It's not uniform on any body of water. There's things that can cause ice to be stronger in places and weaker in others, like if anything sticking through the ice. For example, trees in some of our southern Iowa and central Iowa lakes that we built, they flooded the valleys and there's trees sticking through. Those will conduct heat and make it a little bit weaker in that area. If there's a strong current going through there, that also doesn't allow the ice to get as thick. If we have an aerator on there, usually there's signs out that say, caution aerator in use. There'd be an open water hole. Or recently, we've had a bunch of geese that have just recently pushed south. So those holes that the geese were keeping open recently froze, and they're not quite as thick as the rest of the surrounding part of the lake. So there's a few factors. We always talk about, going out there, testing the ice if you're unfamiliar with the area. Don't go out alone. Ice fishing is a very social activity. And this weekend with the weather that's supposed to be in the, above freezing would be a fantastic time to go out because you don't need to be in your shack with your heater going. You can sit out and visit and have a good time.
We had some people out in that sub-zero weather fishing.
You're talking to one of them.
Oh, really? How was it?
It was terrific. We had a great success, and we had to use two heaters in our shack because it was so cold.
All right.
But, just getting out there and setting up and then getting in your shack, get the heaters on, then you're pretty comfortable. but just the coming and going when the wind chill is 30 below.
Mick, I got to speak for the people out there who just don't see the sense of sitting out on ice in a shack. You obviously love it. What is the thrill? What is the appeal?
Well, when you're ice fishing, basically you're set up directly over the fish. Let me go back. If you can pull off a map from our website, we have terrific maps on our website that identify a lot of the places that we've set up structure and habitat to attract fish. So step one, you find one of our maps online, you print it off, you go out there, you find this structure, and you drill your holes, you look down, the fish should be there. You can catch a lot of fish really quickly through the ice because they're grouped up and you're directly over them, and you can continue to place your bait right there.
Mick, I'm going to have to fish with you. I've been out two or three times ice fishing, and not a one. Can we make an ice fishing date?
Anytime you want to go, you let me know.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Mick Klemsrud, Information Specialist for the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks, Mick, and we wish you good fishing when you get out there next time.
Thanks. You too.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Finishing up the hour with Cyclone basketball. Iowa State fans know that Iowa State remains the only school in the country with undefeated both women's and men's basketball teams. Each squad 13-0, off to the best start in the school's history. Coach Fred Hoiberg's men's team ranked ninth heading into Tuesday's home game with number 7 Baylor. The women ranked 11th. That's their highest position since 2002 after winning 82-75 in overtime at Oklahoma. That was on Sunday. Bobby Legess is with us, sports editor at the Ames Tribune. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Let's talk about these stellar Cyclones. What is making them so good? You pick. We start with the men's or the women's, whatever you like.
Yeah, we can start with the men's team, and it starts with DeAndre Kane, a point guard transfer they brought in from Marshall, who's played at an All-American type level. Most games he's putting up near triple-double figures, getting double digits in points, rebounds, assists, played very well. And they have a lot of complementary, really good pieces around him in forward Melvin Ejom. They have Dustin Hogue as another forward. Monte Morris is a freshman guard that comes off the bench that plays very well. It's a team that can score a lot of points, likes to shoot the three and score in transition, and has an underrated defense. And whatever adversity they seem to come across in the game, they seem to find a way to overcome it and win games. And the women's team is kind of built in a similar kind of way. Haley Christofferson is a returning All-American forward for the Cyclones, who's a forward, and she's surrounded with four guards in the starting lineup, most notably Jada Buckley from Iowa, along with Kid Wachowski is another really good one, and Nikki Moody. And they're very efficient offensively, underrated defense, and whatever's kind of popped up with them, they found a way to deal with the adversity and win. They're two teams that really win games the same exact kind of way.
13-0 for both teams. How big of a surprise is this in each case?
Yeah, for the men, it's very surprising. This is a team that people thought probably an NCAA tournament team. They were selected preseason to finish fourth in the Big 12. And right now, you could make an argument that they're the favorite to win the Big 12 conference. You have Oklahoma State and Kansas up there as well, and Baylor, who Iowa State beat at home earlier this week. And on the women's side, this was a team that was expected to kind of compete in what most people thought would be a wide-open Big 12 with Brittany Griner no longer at Baylor, the really superstar player for women's basketball the last several years. And the fact they're undefeated, the most impressive thing with them is they went on the road and beat number 25 Oklahoma last weekend. And in Big 12 play, going on the road to win games is very tough. And being able to do it over a ranked team is very, very impressive.
Bobby, we've got a minute or so left. Give us a look forward to the teams, the schedule that each of the teams will be facing.
Yeah, the men's team travels to Oklahoma on Saturday for what should be an interesting game against an Oklahoma team that's played better than most people figure. They have a possibility of making the NCAA tournament. And then on Monday is the game most people have circled on their calendar. Kansas comes into Hilton Coliseum. Most people remember game Iowa State lost last year, controversial ending. This will be their chance to kind of avenge that game. And for the women's team, they host number 15 Oklahoma State on Saturday. And if the Cyclones are able to win that one, they'll start off Big 12 play 4-0 and kind of sit in the driver's seat with a good shot to win the Big 12 title. Baylor's the other team that Iowa State's kind of dealing with right now on the women's side for the Big 12 championship.
Mm-hmm. How's turnout been for these teams? I imagine whenever you have a winning team, the fans come out of the woodwork, don't they?
Yes, they do. The men's team is routinely selling out games in Hilton Coliseum. Has become the last couple of years under Fred Hoiberg one of the toughest environments for teams to play in. And on the women's side, they've run for years as one of the top 10, top 5 teams in the country for women's basketball attendance. So the fans are continuing to come out in droves, and the teams are giving them a product that they really are enjoying to cheer for.
All right, let's hope there's plenty more to cheer for in the future with Cyclone basketball. Bobby Legeste, sports editor at the Ames Tribune, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again.
All righty. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you missed part of the program, want to take a listen back, remember, you can always go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Listen to a podcast, streaming audio, or download it as a podcast. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday, you'll listen for IPR's Clay Masters. He'll host this program from the state capitol, previewing a session with State Majority Leader Mike Gronstall and House Majority Leader Linda Upmeyer.